Welcome everyone to Animal Voices. Scott Halsey wrote, "The animals are our teachers. They are currently making great sacrifices for us. When everyone has learned from this sacrifice, there will be a new level of relating as equal beings." Yes, in our program Animal Voices, we envision a world where human beings will no longer kill, maim, torture and exploit animals for food or any other purpose. We envision a world where the human race will finally make peace with the animal kingdom and recognize that they are not commodities and that they have feelings and that they that these animals have a right to live a decent life just as much as you and me. Something wonderful you can do for yourself and all life on earth is to eat a diet of organic, unprocessed food that is free from animal products. You're listening to CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, affectionately known as Co-op Radio, your community-based and community-sponsored radio station. Our webpage is www.animalvoices.org, and you can listen to us live on the internet at www.coopradio.org. John Pranger is our webmaster. Alan Jensen is in the control room. My name is Carl Loskin. And in the studio today, we have co-hosts Marge Adams. Hi, Marge.
Oh, hello, Carl. I want to mention a thought worth considering. Until we focus more on compassion for all creatures rather than personal success, status, and self-satisfaction, happiness will elude us.
Thank you, Marge. And John Pranger will be in shortly, at 20 after the hour, he will be interviewing somebody from the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Within a few minutes, we will be speaking with Kevin Bell, the past director of Wildlife Rescue Association, and he has been involved with the environmental monitoring for over 30 years. Then, let me get this straight, at 20 past the hour, Deborah Durham, a primate specialist with the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA, John Pranger will be interviewing her, and at 12:40, 20 minutes to the hour, we will contact Kathy Kanziolka, who is a coordinator for the Sowing Seeds Humane Education Project workshops. And that's a workshop that's being held this coming weekend at the Spec Building in Vancouver. Basically, it's humane education turning compassion into action. So in the second hour of Animal Voices, we will present a program by John Steinman from Nelson with a program about fish farming. And he's called this program Norway BC. Well, we have, I believe, Kevin Bell on the line. As I said previously, Kevin Bell has been involved with the environment, and for over 30 years, he is past director of the Wildlife Rescue Association. 30 years of environmental monitoring. And, well, welcome to Animal Voices, Kevin.
Good afternoon.
Yeah.
How are you, Carl?
Well, it's you've been in the news somewhat this past week because of a somewhat sad event happening in the Burrard Inlet. Maybe you can tell us about that.
Yes, it's a shame. A ship called Andre, owned by a Japanese company called ICF, International Petroleum Corporation, flagged under the flag of Hong Kong, which is interesting. It's one of the flags of convenience, of course, which means a license to pollute virtually in the world. This ship was refueling and spilled some 1,000 liters plus of heavy fuel oil in Burrard Inlet near Lonsdale Quay. So, amazingly enough, I mean, it's obviously either human error or equipment failure. But, I mean, you know, when you fuel your car, Carl, there's an automatic shut-off that stops you spilling that precious liquid all over the asphalt.
Right. Now,
I guess this damn ship didn't have one, eh?
Now, presumably, there's a tremendous amount of bungling here, which I think...
pathetic, yeah.
Let's just go through the details here, because,
yeah,
first of all, there was this human error with a miscalculation of how much ago. Was there anybody standing there watching as this spill went on for such a long time?
Well, this is it. They're still investigating. They don't want the public to know what went wrong. They're trying to avoid that. The lawyer... for the shipping company, a man called Mark Baker, I believe. And I don't know what company it's with legally, but he let me know that it wouldn't be very advantageous for people to keep after this particular news item. Anyway, gentleman is trying to, you know, I guess what he's doing is he's throwing the shadow of slapsuits around, you know.
Who's responsible for the cleanup here?
Well, the company has, ICF, International Petroleum, has belatedly accepted full responsibility for cleaning up everything, including the oiled birds, some 50 plus geese, Canada geese, and cormorants. However, they let it be known that they didn't think really it was worthwhile cleaning these geese. These geese were just,
Kevin, maybe you can keep speaking into the telephone.
Sure,
you seem to be fading a little bit there at times.
Yeah, they weren't terribly enthusiastic about paying the $1,600 each in each goose. The fact is, though, that they sinned. They broke the law. They deserve to have the full penalty of the law applied against them. And if that includes cleaning up rats, then they should bloody well do it, you know? They are a disgusting bloody corporation.
Right. Now, there's a couple of corporations. How long did it take Burrard Clean Operations to actually get there?
Well, they were there within 2 hours on site to start cleaning up. Luckily, C-SPAN International were there right away, and a Captain Joe Shannon, a tugboat captain with C-SPAN, started the cleanup within minutes. He said for 2 hours, C-SPAN were the only people on site doing cleanup. However, Mrs. McMullen, with the Vancouver Port Authority, said that, to a newspaper reporter, the North Shore News, said that Burrard Clean, who are the people supposed to do the cleanup, were on the scene within 5 minutes. Now, she later changed that version rather quickly when the newspaper reporter with North Shore News pointed out that the C-SPAN captain, Shannon, had already told the truth. And she said, they were there within a couple of hours, you know. My goodness, I was caught lying. No, I wasn't lying. I just made a mistake.
The sad aspect of it is that you have been very much involved with the Maple Flats bird sanctuary there.
Yes, the conservation area.
And of course, that as a result of this, that... even if they were there after 2 hours, that so much of it went down, and it's on the beaches in the Burrard Inlet down towards North Vancouver.
Well, this is the trouble. This oil, over 1,000 liters, can spread very fast, and it was already it had already gone from Lonsdale Quay area, and it was at the Second Narrows Bridge and in the marina there, and oiling birds in the marina area. Now, if this had been in the fall, September, any time between September through to March, April, we would have had thousands of ducks, wintering sea ducks and grebes and various other seabirds in Burrard Inlet, and it would have been a big kill. There would have been a big kill of seabirds. It wouldn't have just been, 50-plus oiled birds recovered and possibly 500 dead. It would have been possibly 500 recovered and 5,000 dead. You know, these people are—they try to play this down. Environment Canada, the Vancouver Port Corporation or Authority, and the Canadian Coast Guard—they are very typical civil servants. You play things down. You are the servant of the international oil or shipping company, and the shipping company in this case is, of course, a Japanese company, and the flag it's flying is a Hong Kong flag. Now you have to laugh at that. I wonder if they're going to give these people any sort of fine for what they've done with it.
Now, Burrard Clean is operations is they're hired by the oil companies.
Well, they're actually part of the oil companies. Burrard Clean is a subsidiary of Western Canada Marine Response Group, a cooperative. My God, they're communists. It's a cooperative formed by the oil companies in 76.
Right.
I wonder if George W. knows this is a cooperative. No. Oh, this is communism. Anyway, they're certified by Transport Canada, our federal agency, to respond to oil spills. They're supposed to respond within 6 hours. Now, if they took 6 hours to respond to this oil spill, it could have been disastrous. They did respond within a couple of hours, but I mean, gee, I can't believe even 2 hours is bad. I should just say that luckily the oil and the currents in Burrard Inlet did not bring the oil into the Maplewood Conservation Area. It was on the south shore of Burrard Inlet, opposite the conservation area.
Right, which is
sheer luck.
Now, but now the other aspect that was mentioned in an article in the Metro,
yes,
was that... there was another company involved here, Focus Wildlife, working together with...
I never heard of Focus Wildlife until this occurred.
They're working with the Wildlife Rescue.
Well, I think they're hired probably by Burrard Clean, or by... I think they were probably hired a company, the shipping company, ICS, International Petroleum of Hong Kong, Japanese company.
Now, I'd like you to comment on this, because this article in the Metro says, at the time, the bird rescuers were told to leave because, the company had been maligned. So they were told to stop rescuing these birds, but then afterwards the government stepped in and said, well, you can't do that. So one has to look at this aspect of...
It's costing this Japanese, Chinese, Hong Kong-based company $1,600 to clean each bird. So, I mean, let the birds die, and that saves us some money, you know.
So of the birds that are rescued, of course, so many fly away and are never discovered. What would you say the rate is of actual statistics being correct?
Well, according to the Royal Society for Protection of Birds in Britain and the British Trust for Ornithology, and I believe the National Audubon Society, when you release a bird, it's gone through a hell of a shock. I mean, it's just unbelievable, the shock. Some of them die of heart attack when they're being handled. The other thing is, of course, the whole shock to their system, and they've ingested. Even if you clean all the oil off their feathers and they get new oil, their natural oil, back on their feathers, probability is that those birds have ingested toxic oil. I mean, you try eating oil, dear listeners, and you won't live too long. It's toxic stuff, and a small amount will do you in, probably cause cancer. So the problem is that these birds are probably going to die in a few months or weeks or with cancer if they don't die of something else.
Now, with this incident, we hope there's a learning curve here, and there's been a fair media coverage on it, and you as a director of the BC Field Ornithologists Society have done wonderful work.
British Columbian Field Ornithologists.
Right. Now, what would you suggest, looking at this as it's happened now, what would be maybe an improvement? How could they remedy this, or what would your suggestions be?
Well, obviously, I don't know how they fuel these ships, but it sounds as if they're pretty archaic systems, and they don't seem to have much in the way of safety precautions built in if they can spill over 1,000 liters of oil. Of course, the man in charge may have been drunk, I don't know, but it does sound pretty bloody awful. So that should be looked at, and it should be an absolutely foolproof system so that an idiot can operate it without causing spills. That's number one. Number two, if a ship such as this one has a record of doing this sort of thing in other ports, as well as, you know, this port, but other ports in the world, there should be a log kept on this. And if these ships are constantly polluting, if the André, for example, has polluted in Hong Kong or Taiwan or South American ports, then, or any other port in the world, then they should be banned. You know, that's it. Ban the bastards, you know? You take away driving licenses, you take away the license for the ship to operate, and you fine the owners very heavily. These people who own these ships should be really made to understand that they are not to pollute the oceans of the world.
Now, also, I also feel that if you have a fire in your house, the fire brigade will be there really quickly.
Well,
so, how can
that
be?
What you pay your taxes for?
Yeah, how can that system be improved? That you know, it's one thing you're having a oil spill in the Johnson Strait, but if you have it here, where presumably the equipment is ready and available, it really does show a really sad light onto the authorities.
Well,
here,
at the moment, they have a company, Bernard Clean Operations, which is basically an extension of the oil companies doing the cleanup. And it would seem that that's like Fox watching the chicken house, you know? It might be a much better system if they had a totally independent company doing the cleanup, and the oil companies paid directly for that without any questions asked, or the marine shipping companies. I guess the marine shipping companies in this situation are the ones responsible. So, you know, the port has to start getting its act together on its environmental stuff here. I mean, it's very nice to, they set up the Maplewood Conservation Area after a tremendous battle, but it was set up. And, but now they really don't seem to have got the message that environmental issues are very important. And unfortunately, our governments, the federal government is a total disaster at the moment, and of course our provincial government is also a total disaster. So the environment is in tough shape.
Thank you, Kevin Bell.
Sorry for being so depressing.
Yes, giving us the lowdown on this.
Because, well, it's all money, Carl, isn't it?
Out of all this comes, hopefully, a revision of it and these suggestions that you have, that they will be implemented and avoid this further massacre of wonderful birds that live in the Indian
Well, of course, it's
Indian
not just birds. The birds get contaminated. That's what we see. The fish are also being impacted, as is marine life, shellfish, you name it. Wherever this oil, whatever this oil touches, it's going to poison.
Thank you, Kevin Bell, for being on Animal Voices. We really appreciate your contribution towards saving the animals.
See you later.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks.
And over to Alan, and we have a little touch of music here, or whatever. Okay.
Back to Animal Voice. courses on CFO.
It's not on.
Of course it is. Welcome back to Animal Voices on CFRO 102.7 FM in Co-op on Co-op Radio. Are we getting a good signal there?
Take that.
Okay.
Oh. Right. Well, this is a bit clumsy. Anyway.
Harry Harlow started a whole new fad in the 1950s, taking infant monkeys from their mothers and subjecting them to various torments in studies that he called studies on the nature of love. Now, most vivisectors like him profess to be full of love for humanity and great animal lovers to boot, and to suffer more than the victims themselves from the pains they're obliged to inflict on them. Now, Dr. Harlow, who is not a real doctor, actually, he was just a PhD, hence the doctor, Harlow didn't conceal his real feelings when he declared to the Pittsburgh Press in 1974, "The only thing I care about is whether the monkeys will turn out a property that I can publish. I don't have any love for them. Never have. I really don't like animals. I despise cats. I hate dogs. How can you like monkeys?" Well, tell us about Harlow. We have on the line Deborah Durham, who is a primate specialist with PETA, PETA for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Hi, Deborah.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Well, this is a very depressing business. Tell us about Harry Harlow and what he did and what's going on today.
Well, Harry Harlow began his work in the 1950s, so we're sort of talking about a legacy of suffering by motherless monkeys that lasted more than five decades. And Harlow began his experiments ahead on the nature of love by taking baby monkeys away from their mothers and giving them different kinds of dolls, for lack of a better term, with which to grow up.
Well, he actually called them monster mothers. Didn't he himself call them that? Monster mothers?
He did indeed, because many of these monster mothers actually inflicted pain on the baby monkeys. And these experiments were conducted under the auspices of determining whether or not monkeys would continue to seek comfort from these contraptions that inflicted so much pain on them. Of course, sometimes their nourishment in the form of a bottled formula also came from these monster mothers that inflicted pain upon them. And not surprisingly, these infants developed severe behavioral problems, and it left them with a legacy of suffering that lasted their entire lives. And it's really quite tragic.
And this was supposed to teach us something about ourselves. Is that the idea?
That was Harlow's feeling, that we were going to be able to understand the nature of love and human bonding by breaking bonds in other animals. And that's really quite an odd notion to me as a primatologist, in addition to being offensive to me as someone who has a deep love for animals. It's a strange idea as a primatologist, because what we know about primates, about the entire order primates of which human beings are a member, is that a long-lasting, deep relationship between infant and mother is actually a defining characteristic. So when I'm teaching classes on anthropology or primatology, I tell students that one of the defining traits of primates is that they have a large brain for their body size, and another is that they have an extremely long period of infant dependency. This bond between the mother and the infant is actually something that's part of being a primate, not only for the nourishment that comes from nursing and lactation, but because of the deep social bond and the learning and teaching that take place in the context of that mother-infant relationship.
Well, it certainly is a strange model of reality to have an artificial mother made out of steel wire, which every now and then gives the poor infant a poke, which is supposed to then cause the infant to reject this mother, but in fact it clings even stronger, doesn't it? Because monkey's needs for its mother's body is far greater than even a human being's, it seems to me. An infant can be left in its crib to sleep for hours in the day. That's not true of little babies.
Not at all. In fact, monkeys remain in contact with their mother quite closely for several months after they're born. And first they cling to the belly, the inside of the warm belly, and when they get so big that that baby's getting close to being, drug around, they actually move around and ride on the back. But that close affiliative contact is much more common in monkeys, and it lasts longer than it does for many mothers and infants in the West. Of course, we do have all those societies where babies are strapped onto their mothers and different kinds of carrying devices. But it is a very, very important relationship. And it's odd that Harlow picked up on that, thinking that somehow we needed to understand this bond, when in fact we had decades worth of evidence for it in human beings already.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, John Bowlby is recognized for his important contribution to the understanding of maternal bonding with the work that he did in the 30s and 40s. So this was information we already had when Harlow started. We definitely don't need any more of these experiments. And the thing is, they're going on today with millions and millions of taxpayer dollars in both Canada and the United States.
And it seems to me there's been quite a rise, at least in our awareness of child abuse and neglect in our society today. So it seems to me that there's been quite a degeneration in those days that Harry and his ilk have been experimenting like this.
I definitely agree. We do have a greater awareness of child abuse and neglect now. And it's a societal problem that we all need to address, but certainly ripping babies away from their mother isn't going to give us any insight into that. And furthermore, the experiments that are taking place now at different universities in the United States and Canada use this model, use this idea of taking a baby away from its mother to permanently disrupt its psychology and its health as a, quote, model. They call it a pathogenic rearing experience. They know that it's going to result in pathology, which is just a fancy word for disease of various kinds. And we're talking about psychological disorders, but we're also talking about a permanent effect on the physiology of the animal.
And so they can cure nothing and do nothing about what they've produced. They cannot heal the monkey afterwards.
There's no evidence that there's any recovery in sight for these babies. So once they're not babies anymore and they're not being used in these revolting experiments, they are then turned to a cage to be used in other forms of experimentation. And one thing that we have documented about the effects of these mother-infant separation protocols is that they leave a psychological scar that will last the rest of their lives. There's good, hard scientific data that being taken away from the mother increases the severity of something called stereotypic behavior. These are abnormal repetitive behaviors like rocking or pacing or spinning in their cage. And the best predicting variable for whether or not a monkey will engage in these behaviors is whether or not it was taken from its mother. And yet, we don't do anything to stop the practice of mother-infant separation. And I actually think it gets worse than that, because we do have information also that mother-infant separation is actually linked to self-mutilation. So we have these data from these huge primate colonies that roughly 25% of monkeys mutilate their own body. Now, as self-mutilation in people is viewed as a psychological pathology, this is also a psychological pathology in monkeys, where they're poking their eyes, banging their heads against the side of their cages, chewing off their fingers and toes. And I've actually read of cases where monkeys will tear into their own belly and begin to eat their own entrails because they have no control over their own behavior, because they've descended so far into madness. And knowing that these horrible effects will arise in these animals, the vivisectors who choose to use this model pretend like everything's okay. that, you know, well, you know, this will only last a short period of time, and then they move on and separate more babies. And to think that animals end up in a place with their psyche where they destroy their own body, or are relegated to rocking and spinning because they can't, they have an affect dysregulation that prevents them from interacting with the outside world, is truly, truly horrific. I can think of few things that break my heart more as a primatologist than to think that this is going on.
Yeah, well, mental agony is a terrible thing, and it seems to me that these are sadists and idiots who are greedy for national grants, federal grants. Now, how much is this Davis, for example, how much of the taxpayer dollar is he spending every year, and what great benefit is he conferring on the human race with these lavish expenditures?
Well, Davis's experiments are taking place at Yerkes National Primate Research Center, which is in Atlanta, Georgia. And he's received lots of funding from the National Institutes of Mental Health. The data we have available doesn't give a year-to-year breakdown. Grants are usually given in a 3 or 5 year block as a standard practice. But a 5 year grant of over $6 million has been awarded for this type of research at Yerkes. So this isn't small potatoes here.
What
we're spending
in the
millions
world
of dollars. And Davis is only one of the investigators working on mother-infant separation.
There are
many other individuals. So we're talking about millions of dollars that, and there is no practical clinical application of the research. So that we're taking this grant money, give vivisectors, when in fact we might be able to use that same money to help children human children who've experienced abuse and neglect in their lifetimes.
There isn't enough room in our hospitals anymore for the patients. They're all being thrown out. There's not enough money for these sorts of things. Health care everywhere is breaking down, and millions of people are starving in the world, and this agency, the National Institute of Mental Health, is awarding this kind of money to these basic no-goal research efforts. Seems to me that corruption can't get much deeper than that.
It really is tragic, because I think, in general, people are compassionate, and that they can recognize suffering in animals as easily as they can in human beings, because we, of course, are just other animals. And to think that we would turn a blind eye to the suffering of children who've been the victims of terrible abuse or who have never known love in order to spend money torturing animals is really, I think, a very sad illustration of what's going wrong with our society. And it has to stop, because families deserve better and children deserve better, but the monkeys also deserve better.
Certainly. And can you describe this Yerkes National Primate Research Center a little bit? What does it look like? What is life like for these animals?
Well, Yerkes National Primate Research Center is a large facility in Atlanta, Georgia. They have roughly 3,500 primates at their facility. They are one of the last facilities in the world to conduct experiments on chimpanzees, our closest primate relatives. In addition to chimpanzees, they have macaque monkeys and a variety of other monkeys, including the endangered Sooty mangabey, which is indigenous to West Africa and teetering on the brink of extinction. Unfortunately, their status as an endangered species isn't adequately protecting them from the torture meted out by Yerkes. Yerkes has keeps primates in a couple of different kinds of facilities. In some cases, they're just kept in outdoor pens, which are chained-in yards, fenced-in yards of about 25 meters by 25 meters, and there can be as many as 100 monkeys kept in a pen of that size. There are also monkeys who are used in infectious disease research, which are kept in much more strict and sterile conditions indoors. They're kept in cages, banks of cages, in inside rooms, where you'll go into a room of Yerkes or any other of the National Primate Research Centers, and there are just banks of cages, two and sometimes three high, with walls of monkey eyes staring out. And these cages are very tiny, John. I think it's hard for us to imagine what this type of confinement would be like. It's much more severe confinement than we would even find in a maximum security prison, for example. So when a monkey is sitting in the center of his cage, on the floor part of his cage, it's not unusual for him to be able to touch both sides and the ceiling. So we're talking about something that might be akin to spending life in a telephone booth or a bathroom stall. And these animals never, ever get out of those cages unless they're taken out to be used in experiments.
My colleague Marge Adams has a question for you.
Yes, I would like to ask how PETA is trying to fight against this cruelty.
Well, I definitely spend every day all day long trying to fight against this cruelty. We did initiate a campaign over the spring that was focused specifically on the experiments of Michael Davis at Yerkes University. We launched a letter-writing campaign with Yerkes and also with the National Institutes of Mental Health, who are funding his cruel experiments. And I've written repeatedly to the director of that center, Dr. Stuart Zola, making recommendations about infant care practices that would reduce the cruelty and suffering. While, of course, I'd like to see all experimentation end at Yerkes, I think a first step is ensuring that they receive some basic care. And they won't even respond to the letters or the recommendations. And so we are now in the stage where we're beyond pursuing direct action with them, and we're going on to an awareness campaign and a letter-writing campaign to put public pressure on them to end these experiments.
Okay, and in your magazine, on your online, you have ways for people to do that, to contact Michael Davis himself and to contact also the National Institute of Mental Health, which is funding Davis's experiment, Dr. Thomas Insel, who is the director of the National Institute of Mental Health in Bethesda, Maryland. And there are phone numbers and email addresses for your convenience. So I urge all our listeners to go to the web or I guess that's the best way, unless they have the magazine, to go to the website and do that with PETA and see if we can make a difference here. Well, thanks, Deborah, very much for explaining all that to us. It's a sad story, but got to go now. So thank you very much, and I hope to talk to you again sometime.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it.
And good luck, and all the best to PETA.
Thank you.
Great organization.
Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. And many of our programs can be heard on by going to our webpage. It's www.animalvoices.org. Well, on the line we have today, we have Kathy Kadzioka, and she is the coordinator for the Sowing Seeds Humane Education Workshops. And so that is, let me put it as she said it, humane education turning compassion into action. Yes, what can we do about all this cruelty? Hello, Kathy.
Hi, Carl. Good to be with you this afternoon.
Yes, and of course there will be this conference, two-day conference, starting on Saturday and Sunday at the Speck Building. But tell me, why would you call this the Sowing Seeds Project?
We decided to name the workshops Sowing Seeds Workshops because these workshops are about letting other people know about these issues, but specifically how to teach others about the issues. And we don't just talk about animal protection. We also talk about environmental preservation, human rights, and media and consumerism. So while these workshops don't tell anybody what to do or how to act, they offer positive choices so that people can make change. So we think we're planting seeds in people's minds and hearts for making a better world, hence sowing seeds.
So it's also a project that challenges us to face what's happening on the planet.
It sure does. And instead of thinking, oh, there's lots of evil in the world and on the planet, I like to think of it as a movement for thinking of positive solutions to the problems that we have now. So instead of vilifying all the different causes of evil in the world, if you want to put it that way, I believe that we have the power to change right now, and that by educating others, we can make the world that we want come about.
And you explore the compassionate living, how people can live together with animals, the neighbors, and all people in general. And it's a two-day seminar for educators and the public, of course. So give us a sort of, you've been one of the facilitators, maybe give us an idea of what's going to be happening there, the format.
The workshop is Saturday and Sunday all day. Saturday morning will be introductions and then communication exercises. One thing I've come across in these workshops is that, myself included, a lot of people have a lot of anger around these issues because we see what's happening and we want to communicate with others. So we focus on communicating effectively and transforming our anger into action so that we don't put people off. So there's a big component of communication. Participants will also see a basic class, what we would do if we went into a school or a community group or a religious setting or a camp, any place that these programs could be held, showing the four elements of humane education that we teach at IHE. Sunday morning will be what we call an activities fair, where Dani Denenberg, our facilitator in Vancouver, she actually lives in San Diego, but she'll be facilitating Vancouver. She'll show participants a whole bunch of different activities on a range of topics that participants can use wherever they are and in their settings. And then Sunday afternoon will be some reverence building activities, role plays in the classroom for difficult situations. If students ask tough questions, they can communicate effectively about that. And then some closing activities.
Then maybe you can tell us, how does one deal with a subject like animal exploitation and people feel emotional about it? How does one do it tactfully and in a positive way?
One thing I do is just try to listen. If someone has a lot of anger around this issue, I say, yeah, I feel this anger too. And it comes less down to making suggestions about how to end this and more about how we handle our anger as human beings. I think that when we come to a place of being more at peace with what's happening, then we're more effective in our change-making, whatever that looks like. And I think that education is the most potent form of activism, more effective than leafleting or being at demonstrations. And while I do think that those things are important and effective, I choose to go the route of education so that I can plant seeds. Again, back to sowing seeds.
So the workshops is a wonderful medium for educating people, but what other mediums do you find that people can use?
For educating people, is that what you mean?
Yeah, do you have films or anything like that?
We have a website.
Okay, give it to us.
It's IHED, I-I-H-E-D as in dog, .org. People can go to that website and check out the programs we offer and learn more about our Sowing Seeds workshop.
Right, Sowing Seeds, turning compassion into action, and it very much involves animals, of course. So the two organizations involved, who are they in the Vancouver?
We're sponsored by the Vancouver Humane Society's Power of One Humane Ed program, and also the Vancouver Foundation, who gave the Vancouver Humane Society a grant, which allowed us to have 15 teachers in the Vancouver area attend the workshop for free. Also the Society for Animal Freedom and Equality, SAFE, and EarthSave Canada.
Yes, those are wonderful local organizations that, well, maybe one day do you envisage that people will understand the issues and maybe turn it into legislation, meaningful legislation that will do something about the 9 billion animals that are slaughtered and raised in factory farms each year in North America.
Absolutely. I imagine a future where we have a humane educator in every school, and every child learns about these issues and is offered positive choices. They may not be the same choices I make, but everyone can do something to make a better world so that we can not have any more human or animal suffering on the earth.
That's wonderful.
That for a goal.
That's wonderful. And so thank you for coming to Vancouver. Your people here, your facilitators, and the good work you're doing and spreading it to the educators. And the message will become like a small a snowball that becomes into a gigantic wave that will change the world. So thank you for being on Animal Voices.
Thank you, Carl.
Okay, bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Well, over to Alan. You're listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. And over to Alan. And Alan, do you have a spot of music for us? Over to Alan. Yes, welcome back to Animal Voices on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. And there have been very many animal issues and in the last few weeks. I'll just mention a few of them again. As we know, we had Kevin Bell on there. And with the oil spill is a disaster to many of the birds that live in the Burrard Inlet in the up Indian Arm. And the other issues that have made the press in the last week is also the open season on the rats in Richmond. And so there's been – what basically happens here is that people keep rabbits as pets, let them go, and then they multiply and they're invading the farmers' fields and destroying crops. We will have a program about that later on and see how best we can deal with that. Neutering is obviously a solution to that problem. We had the baby giraffe that died at the Vancouver Zoo, and just another disaster from the animals being kept in captivity. Next week we will have Barbara Barbara on. She will be talking about the bear Boo, and that was the bear that basically was running wild after the during the mating season, and then apparently checked herself into a refuge as well. We also had in the past week the issue with the Vancouver Aquarium. And in this week's Georgia Strait, there is indeed a wonderful article written by Keith Edwards. And I think it's worth reading, because he says about the Vancouver Aquarium's expansion. It's animals in captivity. That's how, what I believe it's all about. It's about education for sure, but we should not be keeping these whales and dolphins in such unnatural conditions. But Keith Edwards, he writes, "I believe that the aquarium's captivity mentality wrongly teaches the values of false conservation, dominance over animals, and humans' inability to correct or change our destructive ways. Instead, we could be investing in both problem-solving techniques using our technological advances and resources by protecting the existing habits and habitats and creatures within them rather than reliance on relocation except under extreme situations. And then Keith Edwards goes on to write that huge educational strides have been made towards animal conservation and awareness. But I would argue that it would have and should have progressed basically solely upon autopsy reports or washed up carcasses, field studies, films, and true rehabilitation incidents, such as oil spills, not through the long-term imprisonment of healthy wild animals. Thank you, Georgia Strait, for publishing that letter. Well, also in this month's Earth Save newsletter, there was a wonderful article, a headline written by Dave Steele, and it's about another inconvenient truth. Now, we've mentioned before in this program the movie that's showing in many of the film houses at this time is Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth. It's a wonderful documentary. I think everybody should go and see it. It'll change your mind. Take your friends to it. It's absolutely worthwhile seeing. Coming shortly will be a documentary about who killed the electric car, showing at Tinseltown soon, if not already. Well, I will read this part of David Steele's letter.
Have you heard that the aquarium is actually serving up a $15 hamburger?
$15.
That's a hamburger with fries, genetically modified fries. $15.
Well,
and yes, what does that do for the world?
And people are sleeping over.
What? My mic's not still not working. Yes, it is. You were looking at the wrong dials.
Okay. we've had a few problems with the microphones here today.
Global warming, fossil fuel depletion, water pollution, desertification, meat consumption is the prime contributor. And here, Dr. Nightingale fancies himself quite an environmentalist.
He does.
I heard him say, "Oh yes." Isn't that his name?
Denial of the facts. So David Steele writes, he says, go see Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth. It may well be the most important film of the year. Al Gore guides us through a fact-filled, highly persuasive exposition on global warming. He convincingly argues that a tremendous crisis is upon us, one that threatens our civilization and our entire planet. It is a crisis of our own making. If we're going to avert global disaster, each and every one of us must take decisive action. We must become active and effective environmentalists. Because David Steele writes about another inconvenient truth. Let's get to it. Within this inconvenient truth is another equally inconvenient truth. Perhaps Al Gore missed it. Perhaps not. His movie fails to mention it. In any case, the truth is, if you're truly going to be effective environmentalists, if we're really going to attenuate climate change, if we're going to put the brakes on the tremendous destruction that we're wreaking on this planet, we're going to have to give up eating meat. In the modern world, it is impossible to reconcile carnivorous diet with environmental responsibility. Then he writes on and he says, when you munch on a burger, bite into a dramatic drumstick or chew on a pork chop, you're having tremendous deleterious effects on the environment. Our hunger for meat is the biggest single contributor to planetary degradation, be it global warming, fossil fuel depletion, water pollution, or desertification. Meat consumption is a prime contributor to the problem. And in the last sentence that I see, I only have a minute left on this program. David Steele writes, in April, researchers at the University of Chicago showed that a person eating an average American diet contributes equivalent of about 1.5 tons more CO2 to the atmosphere each year than does a person on a vegan diet. That's more than the difference between driving a Hummer H3 and a Toyota Prius 5,000 kilometers in the city. Well, you've been listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFR Radio 102.7. And as we started the program, we said, Scott Halsey wrote, "The animals are our teachers. They are currently making great sacrifices for us. When everybody has learned from this sacrifice, there will be a new level of relating as equal beings." You're listening to Animal Voices. My co-host Marge Adams and John Pranger, and in the studio switching the controls. And we've had a few problems with the microphones today, but all is well. And soon we'll be on the program with the next hour will be a recording from Deconstructing Dinner from our sister organization in Nelson. Over to Alan Jensen.
Come and be part of Co-op Radio's Community Dreams Poetry Showcase. We asked local poets to submit pieces under the theme of Community Dreams. Now the audience gets to decide the winners. Join us for an evening of poetry and live music on Thursday, July 27th at Rhizome Cafe, 317 East Broadway, from 7 to 11 p.m. Tickets are on a sliding scale from $4 to $10. For more information, check out our website at cooperadio.org or email communitydreams@gmail.com. All proceeds go to support Co-op Radio, your community radio station.
Spartacus, that is Spartacus Books, is Vancouver's only volunteer-run non-profit radical bookstore and info shop. An alternative to the corporate mainstream, Spartacus carries material on anarchism, women's studies, ecology, labor and economics, race studies, queer lit, underground fiction, and much more. So come check out our cool new digs, complete with comfy couches and free internet and computer access. That's 319 West Hastings, upstairs above Vinyl Records.